So for the last 2 months, most of my free time and extra energy has gone into digging a hole. We aspire to put a patio in our backyard, and so I've been excavating. And the digging has turned into something of a spiritual experience. Not in a sort of like cool Wendell Berry close to the earth kind of way. Really in a sort of exposing different facets of the darkness in my heart kind of way. What I've realized is that in digging this hole, I'm trying to prove myself. I'm trying to prove myself as a hard worker. I am inordinately proud of not having outsourced the labor or rented a machine, that it was just like me and a shovel and by the sweat of my brow. And this part hasn't really started yet, but I very much hope to prove myself as a craftsman, like to do a really good job. Like in my ideal scenario, which I may or may not think about immediately when I wake up in the morning, you all come over to have, you know, a potluck dinner or something, and you don't know this story, and so you go, "Oh, wow, that's a really nice patio. Who did you have do that?" And then I can humbly brag about it, you know. "Well, you know, we put it in ourselves." That rolls through my brain, right? And I realize, right, I'm trying to prove myself in these ways, and the way that I can tell is, you know, one sign is that I'm anxious about it, right? I really want it to go well. I really do, like, wake up at 2 in the morning needing to use the bathroom and thinking about, "Oh, did I square off that edge cleanly enough in the hole? Does it look nice?" So I have this anxiety about how it's going to go. And I also, another sign has been anger, specifically with my younger kids, right? Our youngest son, Jackson, thinks that the whole world is his personal construction zone. And so he's like, he loves this hole, right? And every time I go out to work in it, there are Jackson trucks in the hole, right? And I know that this is not reasonable, and in my defense, it is fleeting, but my immediate reaction is this, like, moment of righteous rage. Like, "How dare you desecrate my hole with your toys?" Right? I'm not in any way defending that. It's just describing. Right? So I'm trying to prove myself with this hole. And it's funny, I'm trying to prove myself as a hard worker, which I more or less am. I tend to work pretty hard. But there's always somebody else who works harder, right? And I'm trying to prove myself as a craftsman, which I more or less am not. Like my craftsmanship is a consistent, solid C-, kind of across the board, right? But whether I'm sort of good at it or bad at it, I'm still trying to prove that I am enough. Right? Now, digging holes is far from the only way that I try to prove myself. It's far from the only axis that I measure myself on. And I'm guessing that there are other ways that we collectively try to prove ourselves. So I'm curious, how do you try to prove yourself? And yet, this is not a rhetorical question. I'm asking for answers. And I encourage you to be as specific as possible. Right? Don't say achievement. Right? Say, "I've got exams coming up next week, and I want to do better than my roommates and prove myself." That's specific. Okay? So how do you try to prove yourself? Vanessa says, "Making the most magic, having more fun than anybody else."
Doing the 4-star
of the Sudoku. Oh! I love that one because it's so trivial and so true. Doing the extra hard Sudokus, not just settling for the easy ones in the Monday paper.
Completing the crossword only one time through.
Completing the crossword the first time through. Yeah, Joan?
No.
Making the bed perfectly.
By being the Yoda of the faculty assembly.
Ooh. Being the Yoda of the faculty of Santa Ynez Christian. Extra treasure in heaven to the first person that makes Tim a Yoda hat that he now has to wear to faculty meetings. That's going to be applicable in a little while. Being the most generous, outgiving others. One or two more. Say that again. That's true. Andy's a couple years ahead of me on the in-ground patio excavation. There you go. Winning at grandfathering. Peter says giving away the best tasting watermelons, which, to be fair, I think he's going to prove himself. Like, is anybody else in the competition? We had store-bought watermelon for dinner last night, and we commented, you know, out of the blue. Peter would be so disappointed in us for eating this store-bought watermelon instead of waiting for the real thing. Right? So there's a million ways to prove yourself, right? Including plenty of religious ways. Right? Knowing the most answers in Sunday school, reading through the Bible the fastest, whatever. Right? But the book of Deuteronomy and the entire Bible is a book about a more excellent and entirely different way of living. Not a different way for us to prove ourselves or a method that will guarantee we succeed in proving ourselves, but a way to live without the need to prove ourselves in any way. To live not by proving, but by grace. To treat life not as a contest to be won, but as a gift to be received. We've been working our way through Deuteronomy for a while now, and chapter 26 is at the end of the longest section of the book. The chapters 12 to 26 are all commands. Here's how to live well. Right? And so even though Moses, the author, spent a long time at the front of the book saying, this is by grace, this is not a way of proving yourselves, after 15 chapters of commands, we've forgotten. And we're trying to keep track of all the different commands that we can keep and thereby prove ourselves. And so he concludes this section with a double reminder. This is all about grace. I did not just give you 15 chapters of how to prove yourself as being the most holy, how to win at church. I do not want you seeking to prove yourself to me or to yourself or to one another. I'm inviting you to live by grace. And this double reminder, the first two-thirds, three-quarters of the chapter is kind of a specific example of that reminder that has to do with generosity and giving. And then the last four verses are re-summing up in a more general way. This reminder to live in an entirely different way. And we're gonna take those in reverse order. We're gonna do the general and then the specific. The general, we were made to live by grace. And then the specific, we were made to give by grace. That's the call here, to live by grace and to give by grace. So first, live by grace. I'm going to read these four verses, 16 to 19, in a moment, and there's going to be grace in there that it's going to take a little bit of unpacking. There's also going to be a fair bit of obedience, of doing what you're supposed to do, and the order is going to matter a lot here. The order of this life always goes grace, obedience, blessing. First grace, then obedience, then blessing. And we're going to see that both times in living by grace and in giving by grace. It's grace, obedience, blessing. So listen to verses 16 to 19 that teach us to live by grace. This day, Yahweh your God commands you to do these statutes and rules. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart and with all your soul. You have declared today that Yahweh is your God and that you will walk in his ways and keep his statutes and his commandments and his rules and will obey his voice. And Yahweh has declared today that you are a people for his treasured possession, as he has promised you, and that you are to keep all his commandments, and that he will set you in praise and fame and in honor high above all nations that he has made, and that you shall be a people holy to Yahweh your God, as he has promised. Okay. Grace, obedience, blessing. The first two verses are obedience, and then verse 18 is about the grace, but the first two verses, 16 and 17, they're in the future. We're promising we will obey. And verse 18 is set in the past. Yahweh is declaring that we already are his treasured possession. And that's the grace. Okay? Having been given that grace of being Yahweh's treasured possession, we promise now to obey his commandments and his statutes with all our heart and all our soul. The grace here is to be Yahweh's treasured possession. That word, treasured possession, it comes up several times in the way that God describes his people, and it evokes a specific image. So it doesn't just mean like any trinket that you're attached to. In the ancient world, only kings had treasured possessions. Nobody else could have them. And that's because in the ancient world, the king owned everything in his kingdom. Right? There were no private property rights. When the king levied taxes, he was just taking what was already his. Right. And so everything in the kingdom is the king's possession, but not everything is his treasured possession. The treasured possession referred to actually a fairly small number of specific items that the king particularly delighted in. Right. And these were not items that were important to the king because of how useful they were. The army that protects the king's kingdom is not his treasured possession. It was usually just like a chest or maybe a wagon that went with the king everywhere he went. And these were particular possessions that for whatever reason the king didn't just own, he delighted in. He cherished. He treasured. They evoked joy in his heart to have them nearby. And that's why he kept them with him all the time. And what God's saying here is, you, my people, you are my treasured possession. It's not just that I own you in the way that Yahweh, as the creator of everything, has ownership rights over every single molecule in existence. And it's not that you're useful to me. I don't need you to be my army or defend me or go out and take territory for me. It's just that I delight in you. I cherish you. Being near to you brings joy to my heart. You are my treasured possession. And this is grace. It is a gift. You didn't do anything to earn it, which means you can't do anything to lose it. I just delight in you. And to the degree that we understand that, we are set free from needing to prove ourselves. You don't have to show anyone that you're valuable if the king treasures you. You don't have to prove your worth if God finds you worthy. Worthy of delight. Worthy of keeping nearby at all times. This is why when Paul prays for ancient Christians, he prays that God would give them the strength to believe that they are loved by God. That's his prayer for them, that they would actually believe God's grace is real and be able to live by it. Because if that happens, they'll be free. They won't need to scrabble around proving themselves. They won't need to be anxious and angry anymore. You are God's treasured possession. He doesn't just own you, he delights in you. He doesn't keep you nearby because he has to. He keeps you nearby so that he can rejoice over you with singing. That's grace. And out of that grace comes obedience. Out of seeing how much the King desires to keep us nearby, we start to desire to be near him, to walk with him, to do whatever we see him doing, to obey all of his commands. Grace leads to obedience. This is verses 16 and 17. This day, Yahweh your God commands you to do these statutes and rules. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart and with all your soul. Right? The idea here is that being totally secure in God's love and delight actually gives you the foundation to grow up in obedience. Right? That God's grace is good soil that you, the seed, can be cast on and become something more. Right? In the same way that the steadfast, gracious love of parents is not supposed to hold children in infancy, but give them the foundation in which they can grow up and mature. Right? That's the picture here, that grace leads to obedience, not the other way around. We don't have to go out and earn God's love by obeying. His love leads us to obey. And what sort of obedience does this grace lead to? We could say many, many things about that. Two comments. One, this is an obedience of our whole heart and soul. That's how verse 16 ends. We will keep his commands with all our heart and soul. We spent a long time on this when we worked through chapter 6, so I'm not going to talk about the details of what heart and soul means. I want you to see that this is from the inside out. In the same way that God doesn't relate to his treasured possession just sort of rotely going through the motions under obligation, but delights to have us near. We learn not just to go through the motions of obeying, but to find joy in obedience. The movie Chariots of Fire tells the story of two British sprinters at the 1924 Olympics. And in a lot of ways, their stories are parallel and similar, right? They both kind of come from anonymity, and they make the Olympics, and then they win their races, and they celebrate. Right? So if you were sitting in the stands, these two guys, Harold Abramson and Eric Liddell, would look the same. Right? But when you get close, they couldn't be more different. Right? Just before he goes out on the track to run the 100 yards, Harold Abramson is with his trainer, and he's experiencing something close to despair. And his trainer's like, "What's going on?" And he says, "I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to have 10 lonely seconds to justify my whole existence." He runs to prove himself. And something in him knows, like he could lose and fail to prove himself, or he could win and prove himself for a moment and get the medal and the applause. And then next year or the next week or realistically later that afternoon, need to prove himself all over again. On the other hand, Eric Liddell trying to explain to his sister why he's running. He doesn't say anything about proving himself. He says, "When I run, I feel God's pleasure. I recognize that I am his treasured possession and that he delights in me. And so I'm not going out there to prove my worth. I'm going out there to celebrate with my maker." Right? Heart and soul obedience from the stands is not going to look very different from grudging obligation obedience. But if you get close, if you're a colleague or a family member, you can tell. You can see the difference between obeying joyfully and obeying with a burden on your back. And the kind of grace that God offers us as his treasured possession leads us not just to go through the motions of obeying, but to celebrate, to rejoice in our obeying. Grace leads to obedience, to living by grace, and that living by grace leads to blessing. Grace, obedience, blessing. The blessing here is in verse 19. And Yahweh will set you in praise and in fame and in honor, high above all nations that he has made, and that you shall be a people holy to Yahweh your God, as he promised. If you read that sort of quickly and shallowly, it can come across as the blessing that God is going to give you is celebrity. Everybody's going to know your name. Right? People are going to be waiting on Monday morning on the Calvin website for the next sermon to upload, just so they can listen to it. That's not what it's talking about. The name that we get, the praise that we get is from being holy to Yahweh. Holy means distinct, set apart. One of these things is not like the others. And so to be holy to Yahweh is not just to be weird, but to be far more like him than like the rest of the world. In one of Paul's phrases, smell like Jesus. After he ran and felt God's pleasure, Eric Liddell went to China to serve as a missionary, and he was still there in the 1930s when Japan invaded. And he, like most of the other Western missionaries, was rounded up and sent to a prison camp. And if you don't know a lot about Japanese prison camps during this period in history, was awful and dehumanizing. Brutal guards, not enough to eat, no version of care or provision. And most of the people in these camps, including most of the missionaries, broke down. They were dehumanized by the conditions and began to slip into sort of survival mode, functioning like beasts, trying to hoard as much as they could for themselves, avoid any work duty that they could avoid, collect any food that they could collect, even if it meant stealing. Eric Liddell was different. We know this not from him. He died in the camps. We know this from another Westerner whose name I've forgotten, who survived and didn't go into the camps as a Christian, but saw this man in the midst of these conditions, going out of his way to bear the burdens of others, to work extra for those more frail than him and spare them the labor. Go out of his way to give his portion to whoever seemed neediest, whoever came across him. Winning a gold medal and starving to death, Eric Liddell smelled like Jesus. And his name is still known. Right? Even though he didn't experience earthly fame. Right? Almost 100 years after his death, his story is still told. That's the blessing. Right? That in receiving the grace of being Yahweh's treasured possession and learning to live by that grace in joyful obedience, we will not become impressive and renowned in our day and in the world's eyes. But we will become a part of a story of grace that will outlive the fame of every name that we all know in this generation. Grace, obedience, blessing. We're made to live by the grace of Yahweh. That's what the whole book of Deuteronomy is about. Even the super weird stuff. And most of chapter 26 is a specific example of living by grace. And we know that it's meant as an example here because it's actually a repeat of instructions from several chapters back, chapters 12 and 13 and 14, right? It's not new commands. It's a return to how to give by grace, right? Moses, he picks giving, finances, being generous with our resources because, as Jesus said, where our treasure is, there will our heart be also. Right? Realistically, even if I'm your pastor and if you have an accountant, your accountant probably knows as much or more about your heart than I do. Because money is illuminating. And so Moses lands on this example to show us that living by grace affects all of life. And so not only do we live by grace, we give by grace. Let me just read verses 1 through 11. When you come into the land that Yahweh your God is giving you for an inheritance and have taken possession of it and live in it, you shall take some of the first of all the fruit of the ground which you harvest from your land that Yahweh your God is giving you. And you shall put it in a basket. And you shall go to the place that Yahweh your God will choose to make his name dwell there. And you shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him, I declare today to Yahweh your God that I have come into the land that Yahweh swore to our fathers to give us. Then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of Yahweh your God, and you shall make response before Yahweh your God. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians treated us harshly and humiliated us and laid on us hard labor. Then we cried to Yahweh, the God of our fathers, and Yahweh heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. And Yahweh brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great deeds of terror, with signs and wonders. And he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground which you, O Yahweh, have given me, and you shall set it down before Yahweh your God and worship before Yahweh your God, and you shall rejoice in all the good that Yahweh your God has given to you and to your house, you and the Levite and the sojourner who is among you. All right. In our giving, grace, obedience, blessing. We are meant to give by grace. First, the grace. This is really in verses 5 to 9. Right? So this seems like an opportunity for the people to stop living by grace. So the context here is they've been out in the desert for 40 years, the entire lifetime of most of the people, and every single day they've been fed by grace. Bread fell down from heaven, and that's how they've stayed alive. And they're finally gonna go into a land where they can grow food. And the invitation, the command here is to work hard on the farm all year long, and then as soon as anything starts to be produced, collect some of it and bring it to the priests and offer it as an offering. And I'll tell you what I would want to say with all of my heart and soul. Look what I did. Isn't this impressive? This was a lot of hard work. And because I'm very nice, I'm going to share it with you. But instead of that, we are commanded to take that basket and set it down and say, look what God did. And then retell the whole story, going all the way back to Abraham 500 years ago. A story of God's gracious rescue, where he took us down into Egypt, and that provided for us in the midst of a famine, and then we stayed because food security sounded really nice. But then it turned out that staying there meant serving Pharaoh, a hungry God who took everything he could get from us, made us prove ourselves with labor every single day. And we were, when we were finally beaten down and crushed enough under the burden of having to prove ourselves to Pharaoh, we cried out to the true God, and he saved us. He didn't just rescue us from proving ourselves to Pharaoh and then do what every other god would do, say, great, now you get to prove yourself to me. He rescued us from having to prove ourselves to Pharaoh and then said, watch me prove myself to you. I'm not hungry at all, but it would be my delight to feed you. I don't need you to give me anything, but it would be my joy to give you everything you need. That's the grace. That's the story that we get to tell in being generous. That anything we give, right? I've never been a farmer, but this is not the equivalent of writing a check, right? There's lots and lots of work in this, and then there's travel to bring it at a critical time of the harvest season, actually right about this time of year. And everything that we have to offer is just an opportunity to say one more time, I was enslaved to hungry gods, to 100 different ways of having to prove myself over and over and over again, and Jesus set me free. He brought me out of slavery. And even though he had every right to say, all right, everything you owed them, now I want it. He didn't just rescue me from them. He gave himself to me. What amazing grace. Every time we give, no matter what we give, is an opportunity to retell that story and to tell it to one another. Did you guys notice this is not a sort of like super private, individual, quiet time experience? That you brought your gift to the public place of worship and you handed it to the priest, and then the priest set it down, and then you turn around and you tell the story to the gathered community, and then somebody else comes forward, and then somebody else, and then somebody else, because we always need to hear the story again. We always need to hear of God's grace. And that grace, that overwhelming generosity of God, that leads to obedience. And it leads to heart and soul obedience. Not going through the motions, not trying to earn something. There's a couple of things kind of glaringly absent from this passage in terms of motivations for being generous. There's nothing in here about using generosity to prove yourself. There's nothing in here about earning God's blessings through your generosity. There's nothing in here about sort of being motivated by the guilt of wealth. You know, these are all folks who, like, they've been subsistence people, and then all of a sudden they're going to have abundance when God brings them into the land. And there's no hint of, like, you know, we feel bad about having all of this stuff. And so now we're trying to give away enough to make that bad feeling shut up for a few minutes and not feel guilty anymore. Right? All of this is about joy. Our giving, our obedience in generosity is meant to be grateful and gracious itself. Right? Of course, it's meant to be grateful. As we've talked about, we're telling this story. We're going back over where all of this came from. Everything that I have to give has already, it's been given to me by God. And I am a recipient of grace before I have any grace to share with anyone else. And I got to remember that. Right? Because entitlement will creep in. And what I received with overwhelming thankfulness the first time will start to feel like what I'm due. The way we do staff compensation here, we try to keep annual increases fairly low and then give a year-end bonus to kind of function in place of arrays. And I didn't know this when I came to be the pastor in 2015. And so we had like our first annual budget elder meeting in November of 2015. And you know, we went through everything and like, all right, what, the cost of living is going up 3%, we think, so we'll give you a 3% increase. And then like, all right, you go out and the elders are gonna talk about you. And then they brought me back in. They're like, we're really glad that you're here. We think you're doing a good job. We'd like to give you $5,000. And I was like, what? Really? Thank you. Overwhelming gratitude, right? And something very much like that has happened every November for the last 8 years. And I still know that I should be overwhelmed with gratitude, but I don't feel it in the same way. It has started to feel like just kind of a part of my annual salary. Right. Entitlement creeps in. And we have to keep practicing being grateful again and again and again. Right. The kind of overwhelming generosity that God shows us in his grace is not any less overwhelming because we've known about it for a while. It's not any less generous because it's reliable and we can depend on it. Grace stays amazing. And we practice staying grateful. Our obedience and generosity, it's meant to be grateful, and it's meant to be gracious. Verse 12 lays out the sort of baseline generosity. It says, when you have finished paying all the tithe of your produce in the third year, which is the year of tithing. Right? The idea here was that a tithe is a tenth, and you would collect this over the course of 3 years. Right? You'd save a third of your harvest, stockpile it. The way you did this with your herds was you counted the increase. Right? So if your herd grew 50 sheep over the course of 3 years, then you would bring five of them to give us the tithe, right? So this is sort of like baseline, just have generosity as a heartbeat in your life. Right? So there's that, but there's also this sort of instinctive, undefined, open-ended generosity with the first fruits, which is as soon as you have anything to give, give. Don't wait for the whole harvest to come in. Don't count it up so that you can make sure that you give 10% down to the penny. Just be audaciously generous. Oh, here's a chance to give something away. Let me do that. Right? Because the grace that we have received is not a like mechanical 10%. Right? Jesus is not sitting on his throne in heaven being like, all right, I owe Tim 7 blessings each year. And it's only early June, and I've already gotten through 6. That's nice. I only have 1 more to go this year. Right? That's just not his heart at all. Right? And our obedience is meant to reflect the king's heart. And so we're meant to give at every opportunity. Right? I'll say specifically to younger people, teenagers, young adults, don't wait for the stable job and the salary and the student debts to be paid off. Give now. Right? Give from your babysitting money. Give from your allowance. Right? Practice being generous now. And I'll say to the folks who've been tithing for 30 years, don't let it just be an automatic thing. Look for opportunities. Where else can you give? What else can you give? Who else can you give to? Is that not God's heart toward you? How else can I bless him this year? Right. Our obedience and generosity is meant to be gracious. It's meant to overflow as God's grace towards us overflows. The other thing I want to say about our obedience and generosity, I meant to say in the first point about obedience in general, which is that grace and obedience in grace is for the wobbly. If you read this stuff about obeying all of God's commandments with all of your heart and all of your soul, it's really easy to get that as you better do it perfect or not at all, But remember the context, right? This is being spoken to a people who have spent 40 years occasionally and accidentally obeying God's commands. And mostly wobbling between forgetting his commands and consciously ignoring his commands. And these words are being spoken by Moses, who knew what God had called him to do when he was a young man and ran away to the desert to hide for 40 years. And then when God came to call him again, argued with God, like all afternoon, had it out with the Almighty about whether or not he was going to obey. This is for the wobbly. Are you invited to give with joy, with gratitude, with overflowing generosity? Yes. Are you made to give, even if giving causes you profound anxiety? Even if it leads you to resent God and the people around you who keep more than you do? Yes, you are. Because where your treasure is, present tense, your heart will be, future tense, also. Those words of Jesus are not just a warning. They are also a promise of the power of grace. That God will take your wobbly, wavering, anxious, resentful obedience and lead you into generous joy. That even if giving causes you to lay awake at night, fretting about how you're going to provide and have enough, God says, you're my treasured possession. Trust me that I'm not going to leave you behind. Engage in generosity. Grow more and more and more generous as time goes by. So this grace that God provides us in rescuing us and caring for us leads to obedience in generosity, to giving by grace. And that leads to the blessing. And the blessing here is joyful community. Giving by the grace of God leads to joyful community. I'm going to reread verses 11 and 12. And you shall rejoice in all the good that Yahweh your God has given to you and to your house, you and the Levite and the sojourner who is among you. When you have finished paying all the tithe of your produce in the third year, which is the year of tithing, giving it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your towns and be filled. Right? That what's supposed to happen is that we give, and that giving leads to the community feasting together. We talked about this the first time we went through the feasts and the givings and offerings, right? The offerings that everybody brought together, they were supposed to provide all the food for these three annual week-long potlucks, where everybody in the community, no matter what they had to offer or didn't have to offer, got to feast for a week straight and rejoice together, right? You, whoever you are, whatever you had to bring, the Levite, which meant like the most religious insider, the pastoral staff of Israel, and the sojourner, the person from some other country who just happens to be living in your midst, right? The most outsider around. Right? And the people who had the most to give, who could bring a full tithe, and the widow and the fatherless, who had the least to give, all rejoicing and eating together, right? That's the blessing, right? If we engage in giving by grace, in growing, in joyful, obedient generosity, the end game for us is not a new and fancy and gigantic sanctuary. Right? The end game for us is a feast with people who would never come together for any other reason. The end game for us is a party that makes the neighbors go, why are those people hanging out? And the only answer is the grace of Jesus. That's where this is supposed to lead us. In the 1940s, France was under the occupation of the Nazis, and there was a little village in southeastern France called Le Chambon, and it was in the foothills of the Alps on the way into Switzerland. And like everywhere that the Nazis occupied, life in France was getting harder and more dangerous for the Jews as the days went by. And the only way out, because the United States wouldn't take them, was for them to hoof it into the Alps and into Switzerland and find not security, but at least physical safety. And so Jews started to trickle through Le Chambon on their way east, headed for Switzerland. And the villagers of Le Chambon, who were, it was not a particularly large or prosperous village. Pretty much every member in the village was a part of the same little congregation. They looked at this and said, here they are. Here are the sojourners. Here are the widows and the fatherless. I mean, really, like, here are the Levites. Right. Here's an opportunity to be generous. And so they would hide them, give them a place to stay where they could rest, where they could eat enough, even though there wasn't a ton of food to go around, and build up strength, and then send them on their way when they were ready with plenty of provisions for the rest of the journey. And they spent the whole war doing this, holding an ongoing Kingdom of Heaven feast right in the midst of the worst that the world had to offer. Did they become astoundingly prosperous? No. But were they blessed? Were they on the down and up? Absolutely. They knew that God had been gracious to them, and they overflowed with generosity in the midst of awful circumstances, and blessing rained down from heaven. Do you see how much more that is than a wealth transfer from the haves to the have-nots? How much more that is than check writing? How much more costly and how much more beautiful? How much more that smells like Jesus, who did not look down from heaven on a world of sinners and say, they're in need of righteousness, and I have plenty. Let me transfer some righteousness into each of their accounts. But became flesh and dwelt among us and feasted with sinners and with tax collectors, so that he could set out of his grace an everlasting feast before us in heaven and bless us forevermore. We are the recipients of unimaginable, amazing grace now and always. And we get to live and give by that grace always and right now. Let's pray. Father, thank you for being so gracious with us, for making us your treasured possession, for rescuing us from the oppression of trying to prove ourselves. Give us the strength to believe you really do love us. You really do delight in us. You really do rejoice over us with singing. And may your overflowing grace flow into every part of our lives. And may we be people holy to you. People who smell like you. People whose wallets and schedules and hearts and souls are more and more shaped by your generosity. Bless us with that, Lord. Amen.